You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM broadcasting from Burnaby.
To Guerrilla Radio, recorded November 8th, 2023. Well, a tapestry of Pablo Picasso's haunting Guernica hangs mutely in the foyer of the United Nations Security Council. The 25 by 11 foot recreation of the Spanish artist's Cri de Coeur, recalling the ruthless bombing of civilians in that Basque town in 1937, had served as backdrop for press conferences in that august body until February 3rd, 2003, when Fearing Life Imitating Art, in the form of George Bush's coming shock and awe destruction of Baghdad, the UN custodians of decorum covered it from the cameras, preemptively shielding Secretary of State Colin Powell from any embarrassment the image might cause America and its accomplices as he laid forth his bogus casus belli for the Second Iraq War. Well, the blitzkrieg of Guernica, inspiring Picasso so long ago, has been reenacted daily in Gaza for the last month, with many times more men, women, children, and animals killed, injured, made homeless, and traumatized. Thousands are dead, hundreds of thousands wounded, but the great resistance feared by Bush and his claque way back when is apparently not a worry for current leaders of the Western world, who remain unanimous and unapologetic in their support of Israel and its project for the new Israel, despite the horrendous cost. William S. Geimer is a peace activist, professor emeritus of law at Washington and Lee University, military veteran who resigned his 82nd Airborne Commission in opposition to the war against Vietnam, and author of the book Canada, The Case for Staying Out of Other People's Wars. In 2020, Bill founded the Greater Victoria Peace School, which he says has since his retirement, quote, been a success, and my board members are carrying on admirably with peace education. William S. Geimer in the first half. And most here have probably forgotten entirely about Guantanamo Bay Prison, set up so long ago to confine the worst of the worst in George Bush Jr.'s global war on terror. Incredibly, all these years later, prisoners still languish there without the benefit of the protection of laws that were once the pride of Western civilization. Andy Worthington remembers, though, and more, he's been working all these years to both publicize the plight of those held and get them real justice. Andy Worthington and Remembering Guantanamo in the second half. But first, Bill Geimer and the Gaza atrocity happening before our eyes. Well, welcome back to the program, Bill.
Good to be here.
Well, it's great to speak with you. You know, and somehow, Bill, 4.5 years have gotten behind us since we last talked. And I listened yesterday to that discussion we had in 2019 following the UVic Symposium, Human Rights in Israel and Palestine, Canada's Response and Responsibility. And everything we said could stand today, as nothing we talked about then was addressed on the national political level here in Canada since that time. Bill, can we begin with the crimes being committed in Palestine right now and the complicity of this Canadian government in them?
Yes, we can, especially the complicity part. But I want to talk about the complicity of my fellow Canadians. We are quite used to blaming our government, and rightly so, but we still have some semblance of a democracy here, I suppose. So I want to talk a little bit about the complicity of ordinary Canadians in what is happening. But if you'll permit me first to say that I'm honored to share time with Andy and be reminded of Guantanamo, lest we forget. I have friends and colleagues who have represented detained prisoners there. And in my book, I wrote of Omar Khadr, the 15-year-old Canadian child soldier, unjustly imprisoned at Gitmo for 12 years. And he is a soldier that I will remember on Saturday. This is a tough time for those of us who are permanently committed to nonviolence. Because the times are toughest when there's a conflict between oppressors and oppressed, And Israel has been killing and displacing Palestinians for decades, arrogantly, in view of the world, full view of the world community. But 54 years ago, I learned from Joan Baez that there is no good violence and bad violence, our violence and their violence. There's only violence, and it's all bad. And it's this truth that aggravates Canadian complicity in the crimes of Israel and tempts all of us to support our violence. But difficult as it is, that truth remains. And permit me just some examples. The brutal attack by Hamas was not only a crime, it was stupid. It was stupid because it gave Israel the excuse for continuing the ethnic cleansing that Israel has desired for years and is revealed by a recently leaked intelligence document. The plan there is for those Palestinians who are fortunate enough not to be among the thousands of civilians, women and children, who are killed, to be forcibly relocated, continuing a policy begun way back in 1948. It's stupid. It was stupid because the predictably vicious response it provoked from Israel makes it much more difficult for peacemakers who want to see Israel abandon violence, end apartheid, and cease being an outlaw state, and just become a responsible member of the world community and to move toward a just and fair one-state solution. This conflict makes that much more difficult for us. And it was stupid because it does not include a realistic plan to improve the lives of Palestinians. The rage of Palestinians and the rage of Hamas is understandable. The violence is stupid and destructive, as violence always is. And by the way, the brutal response of Israel that far exceeds the violence of Hamas was also stupid. It has resulted in a massive anti-Semitic violence wave almost everywhere. And there was already enough anti-Semitism. And Jews around the world have Israel to thank for this latest uptick. So, having said that, why do Canadians either ignore or support Israel's murder of civilians, including thousands of children? And this is just my view, but over a long period of time, I think it's because Canadians do not yet grasp the concept of accountability for crimes committed on their behalf and in their names. And I think, you know, I spent a number of years as a law professor, and law professors are prone to use hypothetical examples to make points about the real world. So permit me, if it's okay, I'd like to offer a hypothetical to explain what I mean by Canadians not grasping the concept of their accountability, their complicity for crimes committed on their behalf and in their names. I suppose you have come to hate a neighbor, and he doesn't live next door, rather some distance away, but in the same development with you. You've received repeated reports from sources you rely on that your neighbor is an evil person who's a threat to you, your children, and everyone in the area. Your neighborhood governing council decides that this evil person should be killed. And the council approves a special voluntary levy to purchase weapons, come up with a plan, and eliminate the evil neighbor and his entire family. And you willingly pay the levy and remain silent on the plan. And the question then is, are you responsible to any degree for the ensuing death of the neighbor, his wife, and his children? Does that sound bizarre? I suppose it does. It sounds quite bizarre. But my fellow Canadians, that is exactly what you are ignoring or supporting on a national scale.
Can I pick up on the Hamas? Stupid they may be, their goals, we don't know for sure, although they've made some indication of what they had in mind. But was it illegal of what they did, breaking out of the prison that they're in and attacking military bases? And yeah, there was people, civilians that were caught in the crossfire, that were targeted, that were kidnapped as well during the course of this by both sides. Incidentally, the IDF, their Hannibal directive says that they should kill people rather than allow them be kill Israelis rather than allow them be taken hostage, which they did in great numbers, but we don't hear much about that. But what about the legality of what Hamas did, what Hamas did?
Well, I did not. There is such a flood of comparisons between their brutality and our brutality, depending upon what side you're on, that I really chose not to speak about that, because to me, it's self-evident. There is a body of international law, fortunately, that condemns killing civilians in armed attacks. And Hamas and Israel pretty well disregard that. There's no legality to what Hamas did, in my view. Now, I have already, it's funny that you used one term you used, I have used. This whole business of labeling everybody as terrorists. And in an exchange with someone recently, I said, you know, I never saw when Israeli settlers murdered innocent Palestinian farmers, I never heard them referred to as terrorists. So I would like to see an end to this referring to a terrorist attack. It was more, I said, like a violent jailbreak from one of the world's largest outdoor prisons, larger even than Guantanamo. In my view, there is no justification for killing civilians. If you are engaged in a military operation and there is a risk that you're going to kill civilians, much less that's part of the plan, just a risk, then you cancel the operation. That's what the law provides, and I don't see it being done on either side in this tragic kind, which is not to say that there is any sort of equivalence. Israel has had no sense of proportionality when it comes to everybody adopting violence. Israel has not had no sense of proportionality for forever that I have ever seen.
And proportionality, Bill, we should explain, that's not just a term, that's a legal concept.
Yeah, but it's funny because it's also a Judaic concept. The biblical command, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is a limitation on violence. No more than an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. You don't dismember someone or kill them in response to their violence putting out your eye. That's what the Israelis have ignored or forgotten about for years. And it is a concept that has translated into the concept of proportionality in international law.
Yeah, and that is obviously being transgressed here many, many, many times over. We'll get into a little bit more about Israel's reaction. But before we do, it's everybody that talks about this talks about Hamas and what they did. And then that is the frame of reference for everything that follows the discussion, as if nothing came before October 7th, the years and years under which Palestinians have been oppressed and killed and unjustly imprisoned. There's thousands of Israelis, or of Palestinians rather, in Israeli prisons right now, men, women, and even children under administrative detention without trial, without evidence being presented, without any hope or knowledge of when they might be released, similar to Guantanamo Bay. Much of what Hamas has said the reasoning for what they did was to capture Israeli soldiers and whoever, citizens obviously, and use them as bargaining chips to get women and children and their compatriots released from detention in Israeli detention right now. So that's just one of the things that Hamas has said. And I don't mind speaking that up. Everyone who talks about this says, I don't want to be an apologist for Hamas. I'm not apologizing for Hamas when I say that, but I'm trying to understand what their reasoning and what their aims and goals were beyond saying it was just stupid. They had to know, as you said, it was predictable, the Israeli reaction, but they did it anyway. Given the situation in Hamas, there's been UN reports year after year saying that right in 2020 that Gaza would be unlivable. Then there was in 2021, Gaza would be unlivable. Every year they say, oh, by the next year, it will be impossible because of the conditions there with bad water and everything else, the embargo of medicines and so forth. So I guess that my question is not to justify anybody, but to understand that Hamas, it seems, took this drastic course of action because they felt something had to move, and this was the only way to get it to move.
I want to go back to a point of agreement that I have with you, and I think you really, I'm so glad that you said, I don't want to defend, I want to understand, and there's a lot that is not being understood, and you made a point that I'd like to emphasize and agree with you on. And my position, as I said, is that the violence of Hamas is understandable, but strategically, tactically, and in terms of getting anything, it was stupid. That doesn't mean that a concern for those who have been unlawfully imprisoned, the Israeli held hostages for years, are not a legitimate matter of concern. And I'm always interested when we talk about ceasefires, or in this case, freeing the hostages, and they're talking about hostages held by Hamas, that first of all, you have a bunch of right wingers saying, well, don't talk to them at all. And then the freeing becomes a negotiation in which you release all the hostages and I give you nothing. And negotiation doesn't work that way. Every time I hear of a negotiation, I want to know what one side is willing to give up as well as the other. So hostages are not going to be freed probably until some of the hostages held by Israel are freed. Part of the understanding is understanding negotiation.
Hamas did release a few hostages, and they made overtures that were ignored. But I wonder, Bill, if right now Canada has been proud of itself for bringing into the world the so-called R2P, or responsibility to protect. In this sense, does Hamas not have a responsibility, given Israel, the reaction of Israel, the unrestrained reaction, really, of Israel, even while hostages are held, but the realistic fear that once hostages are not there, that onslaught by Israel will be magnified even more, rather than getting anything? All they'll get is Israeli bombs in double time. Does Hamas not have a responsibility not to release those hostages to protect the people in Gaza?
I would say that it's for another time and another program. I had high hopes for the doctrine of responsibility to protect until the U.S. bamboozled the UN into Libya. But my thought about your comment is that Hamas should not release the hostages until it gets something back. What that return is, would be, up to the parties. But there's nothing unreasonable about what you have said, and if I were a bargaining person, I might begin by saying, this status is not going to change until you quit bombing our, you know, our people.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably something that's on the table right now. I hope so. But watching Western media, you know, you can't see what that position would be, because all you see is either don't talk to these evil people or just make it a one-way deal. They must release and get nothing back. And I think, if I could, I'm not going to spend as much time as I had planned, but going back to why Canadians sit by and either support or just let this happen, I think you know that my position is that Western propaganda plays a tremendous part. Propaganda is how we as Canadians decide not to get involved. You will not find any Canadians in the grocery store line who are willing to say, boy, I support the Canadian-U.S. Israeli killing of thousands of children. But you will find a bunch of people in the grocery line who don't want to talk about it. And that is a result of propaganda that goes back to so many wars. And I thought the last major one was selling the lie that Canadian forces went to Afghanistan to build schools for girls. That was the last flag I had that said, beware of propaganda. My concern is my fellow Canadians, because if their support disappears, then the country as a whole changes course, and we don't become complicit in the crimes of Israel. And everybody has propaganda. Hamas certainly has propaganda, but Hamas is not speaking on my behalf and in my name.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with William S. Geimer. Bill's a peace activist. He's a professor emeritus of law at Washington and Lee University, military veteran, and he resigned his 82nd Airborne Commission in opposition to the war against Vietnam and came to Canada to become a Canadian citizen and live here among us. And he's been here ever since. His book, Canada, The Case for Staying Out of Other People's Wars, is timely even yet after how many years since you've written it, Bill. And he
I'm
also
very sorry that it is still timely. It came out in early 2017. And as I was looking back over some of the propaganda things today and looking back over the Guantanamo section of the book, I again felt regret that so many things are still timely. If I have just a moment, I want to close or at least come to mention what I think, where do ordinary Canadians go from here? And how do we speak to them? One of the things you can do when you're just frustrated is to donate, find a place and give what money that you can. And my choices, as far as Israel is concerned, is an organization called Combatants for Peace, cfpeace.org, and American Friends of Combatants for Peace, afcp.org. These are Palestinian and Israeli veterans working, who oppose the occupation, who are working for peace, and great groups. And of course, worldbeyondwar.org is a great place to put your money. Second, I would say, don't be afraid to speak respectfully but forcefully to your fellow Canadians about their complicity and about the need for a ceasefire and the need for peace. And I've learned over the years that you can start with other subjects. You don't have to say, what about Israel, to someone in the grocery line, but you can talk about the allocation of resources. And as a retired barrister, I can also say that the best way to do this is by asking questions. You can start with grocery prices, and you will get to the multi-billions of dollars being wasted, regardless of the human rights violations. There are many ways to talk with our fellow Canadians, and I encourage us to give what money we can and not to be afraid to talk to our fellow Canadians.
Well, yeah. Well, what the effects of all this are having on our societies as well, and we've seen country after country in the G7 change their laws to make them less and less democratic. France and England, and making it illegal to show the Palestinian flag, much as it was illegal in Israel years ago. And there was an arrest in Calgary just recently of somebody that was intoning the chant "From the River to the Sea," which you hear at these demos that have been huge all over the world. Somebody was arrested for that because the charge interpreted that as being a threat, an anti-Semitic threat. I want to mention too, before we go though, Bill, that people can also get involved with an organization that you founded, the Greater Victoria Peace School. Can you tell us what that is and how people can get involved in the work they're doing?
Greater Victoria Peace School, it's just peaceschool.org, ran a summer course in Victoria, was a co-sponsor of the Hiroshima Nagasaki observance here. We have a board member of Japanese descent who is a marvelous person. And we had a lecture series over last fall, a series of workshops. And one of them was led by a noted author and peace activist, Mary Wynne Ashford, who tragically died shortly after making this great presentation that she gave. And Mary Wynne had put together a series of instructional videos in peace education. And what the board is carrying on with now that I have retired is to update and modify, in Mary Wynne's honor, her series and get it into secondary school curricula all across the Greater Victoria area. And they're having success with that, although they are doing something that I would rather have a root canal than do, which is to fight their way through the school bureaucracy in order to get this course into a secondary school curriculum, but they'll get it done. And so that's just an example of what the Greater Victoria Peace School is doing. There's always something that we can do.
Yeah, that's like my mother used to say, there's always something, but I think she was meaning something else. That's peaceschool.org, cfpeace.org, afcfpeace.org, World Beyond War. They do great stuff. David Swanson being a frequent guest in the past, at least on this show. I'll put those links, Bill, in at my website, guerrilla-radio.com, where this program, one of the places this program will appear, and people can link to that. Bill, we're fast out of time, and there's so much more that we could talk about as usual. Our foreign minister, Melanie Joly, or Genocide Joly, as I like to call her, was presenting in front of the G7 today, their meeting in Asia, I believe it is, and she announced that the G7 countries are, quote, united in our condemnation of Hamas's terror, our support of humanitarian pauses in Gaza, whatever that means, and our support for Ukraine and that continuing war. So it's simmering, but not yet extinguished there. Joly is hoping that will continue, I expect. Bill, it's a joy to speak with you. Let's not wait 4.5 years before speaking again, eh?
No, definitely not. And thank you for all your work. It's just been great to get reunited again.
Likewise. And I want everyone to stick around after the break. Andy Worthington's going to be up, and we're going to talk about his 20-plus year odyssey trying to get Guantanamo closed and justice for those held there. And it's still going on all these years later. Thanks again, Bill.
My pleasure.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere at guerrilla-radio.com.